he had some piece of knowledge. Someone had told him or taught him a very small skill, and that small skill had a huge impact in his career. And I actually didn't know that that was something that was ethical, commonplace, like accepted, all of those things. And because I didn't know that small skill of self-advocacy and pushing yourself together, I was stagnant and he was pushing forward.
Welcome to Sage Advice, the podcast where the future of higher education is not just discussed, it's crafted. Every episode, we dive deep into the transformative world of learning, bringing you conversations with the pioneers and policymakers who are reshaping education today. Joining you from the innovative halls of Western Governors University, I'm your host, Chris Bunnell. Today, we're pleased to welcome the authors of Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact. Dr. Adara Landry is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School with almost a decade of experience mentoring students and early career professionals. She is an entrepreneur, keynote speaker, and award-winning mentor. She co-founded Writing in Color, a nonprofit that teaches the craft of writing. Welcome, Dr. Landry.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Risa Lewis is a professor of emergency medicine, TEDMED speaker, Time's Up Healthcare founder, designer, entrepreneur, and award-winning educator, mentor, and point-of-care ultrasound specialist. She hosts the Visible Voices podcast, amplifying content in healthcare, equity, and current trends. Welcome to Sage Advice, Dr. Lewis.
Delighted to be here.
So right off the bat, can you tell us a little bit of what a micro skill is? And this is open to either of you.
We get this question on these delightful conversations, which we love. So thanks for having us. A micro skill is a fundamental building block, a small concrete step skill that is additive and translatable. And we believe micro skills together added up can help us achieve goals, projects, integrate habits, and basically accomplish all the big things that are overwhelming. It's a process of breaking things down into small pieces so we can get where we want to go in the workplace.
And I would add that some context to why we used the term micro skills. I think people have a lot of questions about why we use that word. And I think at the core of it, Risa and I are educators. We teach early career professionals, yes, in healthcare, in medicine, but the skills that we teach, the themes of teaching someone how to do something are translatable to, I think, any industry, whether it be law, education, consulting, etc. And one of the fundamental things that we have to do as physicians when we're teaching, let's say, a trainee how to do a procedure or how to care for a patient is that we teach the small steps to get to the end goal. So we would not tell a resident to go resuscitate a patient because that word resuscitate is a big, big, overwhelming task. And it's truly a series of very small, small skills, such as assess the patient, assemble a team, assign roles, time the interventions, and so forth. And all of these small things allow you to overall achieve your goal. So even though we have a medical background, we know that when it comes to training anyone in any environment, it's best to really break down those steps. And the reason why we want to do that is because it exposes the knowledge gaps. It allows people to see where they are stumbling and where their obstacles are. In addition, it allows you to track your progress in a much more digestible way so that you can really see how much you are learning and how much you are achieving. And that in itself can sometimes be motivation to continue.
One more thing I'll add is when we were looking at comparative titles, other books that talk about navigating the workplace and breaking things down into small pieces, we didn't come up with that concept. But where we've taken it in a different place is many books will say you should just do it, break it down into small pieces, but they don't tell you how. And as Adara just shared, we provide critical actions. We provide the how. And that's the missing piece, we think, in many of the books we've looked at.
I know we're going a little bit beyond just what is a micro skill. But I would also add that there is something special about this education coming from two women who have navigated a very competitive specialty. To get to become a physician is just quite challenging in itself. And to be able to train at Harvard and stay here where you're working around very accomplished people requires you to understand how to navigate the workplace. And that did not come easy to us, especially to me. I'll speak for myself there. And I have many examples. We have many examples in the book of how hard it was to learn how to navigate the workplace. And because of our background, because it didn't come naturally, no one handed us anything. We felt like it was really important to spell out all of those small steps because we knew how important it was for us in our own journey.
I could not agree more. And I think the dynamic that I'm seeing a connection to, although this is my view of the world, is that it's very similar to how WGU teaches its students via the competency-based model. And that is, as we go through a process, there are any number of steps or skills that we have to realize. We have to envision what the hurdle is. And sometimes it is just expected from our education or training that if you have a degree, in your case, medical degrees, of course, you know how to take the steps A through X. But we don't spend the time focused on exactly what it takes to overcome hurdle C or hurdle K and say, this is how you implement this specific function. So thank you for calling that out. It is something that in the skills environment nationally that we hear a lot of is that we've got great soft skills. We've got individuals who have all the knowledge that it takes to do the work. It's just that sometimes we need the coaching of how to make that transition to practical experience. So I appreciate all that you shared with us. The benefits of being a focused, organized professional with the micro skills described in your book are, as we've just been talking, valuable to individual careers. But the compounded implications for developing these skills affects business and the economy as well. So a study by The Economist estimated that inefficiencies at work cost the U.S. economy around $1.3 trillion annually in lost productivity. Businesses benefit by ensuring their employees are proficient in these micro skills. It's clear why someone would want to write your book to advance their career. But can you glean a little more or give us a little more information on what inspired you individually to write it?
Yeah, and thank you for that question. It's a really thoughtful one. I'll share a little bit more about my journey. I sort of alluded to it, and I'll sort of tie it into that element of cost. So when I started at my current hospital in my current department, I, at the time, was the youngest faculty member there. I think the person older than me was like 2 years older. So I was on the younger side. And I was also the only Black woman faculty member. And I had that role or that, I guess I shouldn't even call it a role, but it's true, for about 6 years before we hired the second. And though everyone around me was wonderful, and that is true, people were really and are still really wonderful, I didn't feel like I had an obvious go-to when it came to just navigating the workplace, figuring out how to succeed. I had an academic position, but I felt like years were passing and I was the exact same person year three as I was year one because I wasn't getting any new opportunities. There wasn't any challenge. I wasn't really being pushed or pulled in any direction. And yet I saw a lot of my colleagues getting grants, national speaking opportunities, publishing higher positions, which meant higher salary, all of these other things. And there were many times where I actually thought about quitting. Now, an employee quitting is actually very expensive for any institution because they have to cover that missing labor, recruit someone, which is expensive, onboarding, all of that is there's an economic burden to the institution. But many times I thought, I think I would do better elsewhere. I mean, that's true. I'm very open about that. It really wasn't until I started to find the benefit of asking quite invasive questions. An example of that is when I had a colleague who got this really amazing opportunity and got another one right after that and another one. I just felt like it's time for me just to ask how this is happening. And so I went up to this colleague and I said, how are you finding people to nominate you and to write all of these letters and put these packages together for you? Who's doing this for you? Because it's such a foreign concept to me because no one was doing that for me. And he told me, Adara, I'm doing it on my own. I'm finding the opportunity. I'm writing the letters of recommendation, or I'm drafting them at least. I'm asking someone to put me forward. I'm running the ship. And it was that really small but focused insight that he had some piece of knowledge. Someone had told him or taught him a very small skill. And that small skill had a huge impact in his career. And I actually didn't know that that was something that was ethical, commonplace, like accepted, all of those things. And because I didn't know that small skill of self-advocacy and pushing yourself together, I was stagnant and he was pushing forward. So for me, like just understanding that within the workplace, there are these tricks of the trade. Risa calls it the playbook, and I agree with that terminology. There is this guide of how to succeed, and some people have access to it and some people don't.
My journey has some overlapping aspects to what Adara just shared and also complementary and different. So when people say, why did you write this book? Quite simply, we wrote the book that we wish we had been given when we were starting out. Now, we've gotten there. We've both been successful in our careers. And also, gosh, it could have been easier. Gosh, it could have been more efficient. And there was this feeling for me, and I'll start as early as like high school into college, college into med school, that somehow people knew how to navigate the workplace in ways that I did not. And I didn't know, I'm like, how do they know how to do these things, or who told them? And one of the motivators in writing the book and putting this content out is we want to share what we've learned so that people can actually have an easier time of it. And so the content can really help them. We start out in the book sharing three truths. One is this concept that time is currency. Time can only be spent. So we should be really careful how we spend our time, with whom we spend our time, etc. Then we talk about acknowledge something that I think is really important, that everybody doesn't start at the same place. The starting line is not the same for everybody. So we are very intentional and careful to acknowledge that not everybody has knowledge, not everybody has resources, not everybody has information passed down from generation or from their networks, etc. And then finally, we talk about that learning is just infinite, if only accessible. So we're trying to contribute to that accessibility plate. And I was firmly brainwashed academic. I did everything I was supposed to do, meaning publishing articles in the scientific and medical literature and ascending to assistant, associate, full professor. And in fact, when I joined my most recent institution, I was the first woman full professor. This is in 2017. So relatively speaking, that was quite late and just sort of spoke to some of the aspects of healthcare and of medicine that are quite slow to change and slow to make everything accessible to everybody. And what I sort of did was along the way, I met people and was a part of some organizations that showed me that no, you can write for outlets other than medical outlets. And I found that currency of writing to be extremely impactful in terms of getting messaging out there and in terms of realizing not only just writing, but reading. I'm a huge reader. And Adara and I together have published articles in, for example, Harvard Business Review or Fast Company. And those are not medical journals, but certainly the articles that you can find there about leadership, about communication, about managing a team, those are universal. So we appreciated that the lessons we were learning in healthcare were applicable to other industries. And we started writing articles during COVID together about navigating the workplace. And Adara came to me. She said, Risa, I want to write a book. I'm like, that sounds great. She's like, do you want to write it with me? And I was like, wow, amazing. Yeah, let's do it. And longer of a conversation and thought that went into it. But the bottom line is we'd had a really good track record of writing. We had a really good track record of writing these articles. And we got really nice feedback from people like, wow, that was super helpful. Oh my gosh, I'm going to share this with all my mentees. And it just felt important that we do this, that we get this book out there and share what we had learned in a way that can be helpful to so many more people.
So Dr. Lewis, I'd like to follow up on that a little more in depth. Earlier this season, on an earlier podcast of Sage Advice, our vice president of business school, Mitsu Fraser, spoke about how soft skills, or as we call them at WGU, power skills, are foundational to the world of work. These skills like communication and conflict resolution are critical to almost every profession and are included as teachable micro skills in your book. Can you tell us how you identified which micro skills are essential to professional success?
This is a great question. Thank you for it. And Adair and I had a lot of brainstorming sessions, and we started pulling together from all of our experience, all of the books we read, all of the things we've written, all the feedback, all of our conversations with mentors, mentees, kind of anybody that we've experienced in our professional lives. And we put some of these ideas down on paper, and we were very intentional with bringing other people in as we were designing this book. And designing meaning bringing in some of the end users, readers, people that would potentially use this book. And we had a whole load of beta reading brainstorming sessions. So we got input from people and friends, all different ages, stages, different demographics, different industries. And we got to a point in that sort of fleshing out process of getting a list of skills that we thought were important, impactful, useful, translatable, and would speak to people no matter what their training and what their industry.
Dr. Landry, coming back at you, and we have discussed the workplace inequities, and certainly is something that needs to be more of a direct conversation, whether it is the privileged background component, the workplace playbook, unwritten rules for navigating a professional environment. But the book itself is powerful in its straightforwardness and how actionable the advice is. Levels or attempts to level the playing field for professionals without the advantage of a particular social circle and background. As a girl dad, right up front, please tell me, why was it essential to write something accessible to such a broad range of readers?
I'm just going to say, I love girl dads. I'm married to one. I'm a girl mom. So we are connected. And I think actually your daughter has a similar name to mine, right? Well, wasn't that our overlap?
That was the overlap. Her name is Adara, A-D-A-R-A. So you've got an eye in
there. We bonded.
Yep, we bonded. And I'm going to ask you, do you know what the foundational meaning of the name is?
Well, I think it depends on which language, but there's a long backstory on that. But it's a derivation of my dad's birth name that he was not allowed to have because he was born in a Catholic hospital and there's a church associated with it. And all the babies born there had to have biblical names at the time.
Really?
Yes. So his name is David. And so they ended up naming me Adara. But they wanted to name him Derry, which is kind of an interesting name. And so my mom and my dad said, well, let's name him what I was supposed to be named. Name me. There's a little bit of derivation there. So anyway.
Wow. Very interesting.
You don't have to keep all that in there. But
and we found it in a baby book looking for an interesting name. And at least in the copy we had, it stood for Egyptian princess. And certainly our daughter, Adara, has modeled that through her life and is just a fabulous contributor to society as a whole. And so it is a real genuine pleasure to meet somebody with the same name who models much of that same behavior, if not all of it. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. I love that detour. So as a girl mom, I know how important it is to validate the fact that even if people are in the same institution or the same department or office or group or team, it doesn't mean that they have the same starting place, meaning the same amount of background knowledge or network or finances or dependence or mentorship, right? All of that could be different. And it doesn't mean that they're going to have the same journey going forward, meaning they might have more obstacles. They might have to prove themselves more, work harder. They might not be invited to places like others. And so there's whole challenge of really making the workplace feel equal, equitable to everyone that we know it really doesn't exist. And so we wrote this book understanding and really just being vulnerable with our own personal experiences, right? We include a lot of personal stories about how we witnessed and we experienced ourselves. Some people get ahead of others because of the inside information they had. And so when we wrote the book, we wanted this book to really be accessible. Accessible is the key word. So how do we make a book accessible? Well, one is just the language we use. When we were reading a lot of other business books, there's a lot of language that is heavy in data, heavy in statistics, a lot of case reports that can really lose the reader if they're not really used to that content, if they're not motivated by that. So we really stripped it down to just the bare bones and kept it like as actionable as we can make it. And we really want to appeal to that Gen Z learner where they want fast advice, right? They don't want to read for 3 pages just to get that final nugget of information. And so we really wanted it to be digestible, snackable, accessible, whatever word you want to use. And so that comes from language. That comes from also us being vulnerable with our own struggles as well. So it wasn't like we're writing this from higher ground, like everything that we've ever done is perfect. Like I put a lot of my own personal mistakes in there because I think it's really important for people to just accept that no one is going to be perfect. And so that was important to us as well. I think the third thing we did, and this is, I'm going to give Risa all of the credit, is that we didn't want the book to be something where you have to sit down and read it cover to cover to find out what it is that we address. And her suggestion was to really put a very detailed table of contents out in the front so that if someone wants to work on how not to lie at work, they would go to the exact micro skill titled Don't Lie. And so we wanted to make it as detailed as possible because of the benefit of it being more accessible that way.
Which is essentially building on skills initiatives, is that which you know or are comfortable with, you don't necessarily have to spend a lot of time, at least initially, if there are more critical skills necessary to get you up to speed where you have a deficiency. But Dr. Landry, I'd just like to say, I love the way you characterize that. My term would be that we're all a beautiful mess. And there are certainly things that we can learn, things we overcome. And to think that we have an equal playing field, I think, is to ignore the obvious. But Dr. Lewis, if I was reading the nonverbals right, I think you may have had something to add to that conversation.
I just love so much that was just shared in general, what's being shared in this conversation. But just the beautiful mess part, I think, is such a loving way to say it. That we're all works in progress. And it is absolutely true that we came from a place of structuring the book and the chapters in a way to say, here's a story. The story illustrates the micro skill. We're going to share with you why we believe this is an important skill. We're going to acknowledge it's not easy, it's not hard, and here are some of the reasons why. And then here are the critical actions, here are the steps. I think, as Adara shared, this concept that it's not a cover-to-cover absolute read. You can use it as a guidebook. You can actually flip to the chapter. And I like to share, one of my besties from college is in a leadership position at a huge hospital in Texas. And she has been one of our beta readers. And she said, you know, that she had to have a difficult conversation. And another point, she was leading a meeting. And she said she actually went and read those sections from the book. And she is firmly mid-career, almost late career. And she said it was great and it helped me and it centered me. And so that's sort of the hugest compliment and exactly what we hope readers glean, get, obtain by this book.
No question. It has to be just an amazing feeling to know that on a one-by-one basis, you're influencing lives and directions that people take because they now have the path put out in front of them. And there is nothing better in life oftentimes than to plant a tree under whose shade you'll never sit. And I think you've certainly outlined here a playbook that will last generations. Although we look forward to whatever iterations or reiterations you have of the material. So, Dr. Landry, you write about the importance of building a personal board of directors. At WGU, we're big fans of this concept. We believe that community can be transformative. Our students are paired with mentors. They meet regularly to help them navigate their degree path, to be a sounding board and support their journey. Often these connections remain long after our students graduate and are a testament to the power of positive relationships. Can you tell us about the characteristics our audience should consider when building their personal board of directors?
So building your personal board of directors is aligned or complementary to the idea of networking and building connections. And there is some overlap and there's some difference, but I think at the crux, I want to always tell people that this should happen in a way that feels positive, right? It shouldn't feel overwhelming. It shouldn't feel like a burden. And I think one of the times it feels often for young folks like a burden is when they're really intimidated and they fear rejection and they feel like this is going to be a big lift for them and they just don't have the capacity. And so when I have students or trainees who come to me and they're dreading networking, I always just do a check-in and say, like, if now's not a good time, like, you can hold off and you can table it and work on yourself, work on your mental health, your physical health, your social health, your financial health, whatever it is first. And then when you're in a better spot, we can come back to it. I think that's very important because it is a lot of work to build a whole new community. The other thing I always share is that the expectation should be lowered a bit because I think a lot of people are intimidated and they think that it's like you're getting into this relationship with someone as if now they're your best friend or you're getting married to them. I mean, it's not like that. This is just starting off with a conversation. You don't have to formally email, "Hi, Professor Bono. I would love to meet with you and have you as part of my board of directors," right? Like, it doesn't need to be so formal. It could literally just be, "Hi, I would love to meet with you and ask you this very particular question. Would you have 20 minutes? And just starting off by just understanding who they are. Is this person positive? Are they accessible? Do they have the skills that you want, the knowledge that you want? And that's how you slowly start to build people into your network. When it comes to creating a formal personal board, I think it really starts with you understanding your needs as well as what they are able to provide. Like, I have someone in my personal board of directors who is really great at personal finance. So I go to them strictly for personal finance questions, right? And they come to me for things too. Like, I want to help them as well. But I go to them for questions related to personal finance. I probably wouldn't go to them for questions about managing my marriage or managing my kids because that's not their area of expertise, but they really know money. And so I go to them for that. And so as you start to build people in your network, you will recognize someone's individual and specific strength. And you start to say, oh, this is my person when I have a difficult conversation. I'm going to go to them first, debrief, pre-brief, and try to figure out what I want to say. And then I can have that difficult conversation. But first, I'm going to use my personal board of directors for guidance, for support.
And these people who sit at the table, I think everybody understands it's not literally a table, although it could be a table, but it's not literally a table, but it's this concept of ideally a round table with always open seats. And there are no term limits to this board. People can come, people can go. Some people are with you for a lifetime. Some people are with you for that one 20-minute conversation. These are people you trust, your go-to people who you believe have your best interests in mind. And the relationships can transform. It can be a friendship to a sponsorship to a mentorship to a specific coaching situation. And I have loved realizing the importance of the personal board of directors. And I call upon them. And as Adara alluded to, this is not a one-way conversation. This is not a take-take. This is a full circle give and take, because you care about these people. These people are investing in you, and you need to, should also invest in them by giving, showing, offering. And we speak about in the book about, like, you do have things to offer. If you think you have nothing to offer, you're wrong. You do have things to offer. Let us show you what you can offer.
I think it's also important to add that I was really late to this, and I wish I had started earlier. Like, I didn't know that there were people my age in high school and in college who had mentors. Like, I didn't have my first mentor, definitely not until I was about 25. I was like in my final year of medical school, so maybe 24. And before that, I was just on my own because I thought someone's going to come to me and ask me to be their mentee. And that really wasn't how it went. And so just normalizing that you can reach out to someone now, you don't have to wait until you're more senior. And also, you might hear a no, you might hear no response. And that's okay, because this isn't anything that is like a legal contract, right? You're just asking someone for a meeting. And if they say no, you move on to the next person. So just sort of normalizing that you can network and build this personal board of directors as early as college or high school. And it's not something that you have to put too much pressure on yourself for, that like, if I get it wrong, they're going to be upset with you or they're going to be mad at you. Like, it's just an experiment. I think everyone really wants to support young professionals. I think most of us here do. And I think most people in an educational system would want to as well. And so I imagine WGU is a safe space, and these students, I would hope, would feel empowered to reach out, but they might not know that it's acceptable to do so very early in their career.
No, that's great advice. And one of my favorite quotations that I was given by a mentor, made aware of by a mentor, was from Minor Myers Jr. And that is, go out in the world and do well, but more importantly, go out in the world and do good. As you reach out to a board of directors, a director, a mentor, do the vast majority of people still want to do good?
This is such an interesting question, and I can take it many, many ways. So I had identified someone that I thought was going to be the perfect mentor. This person had a professional journey that I looked at and said to myself, self, this is the journey I want. And I was sure we were meant to be. And I shared this story in the book that I reached out, and there was this big delay to getting that first meeting. And after that first meeting, I had done my research. I was ready. I was prepared with questions. I was convinced after that first meeting that, like, we were meant to be as mentor mentee. And then that second meeting, it was delayed a few times. And then I really started doing this step back and be like, wait a minute, I think they really are not interested in this relationship. And so I was slow on the uptake, but once I got it, I sort of took that person off the board, sort of opened up that seat, so to speak. And I was much quicker the next time to recognize. The reason I share this story is these relationships tend to be organic, and they should be organic. And as Adara shared, they should feel good. It shouldn't feel stressful or onerous. Now, if I can interpret the question you just shared, does everybody have good intentions, or is everybody really have you and your success in mind? And the answer is no. That's not what always happens. Sometimes you and your success are something that's going to benefit the other person. And there have been some horrible stories that we've read about, because people have written about them, about a mentor taking credit for the mentee's work, a mentor being actually quite maybe unprofessional, unethical about insisting on their name being used or being credited. So not everybody has great altruistic intentions. And also, I think by no means is that common. I think that's uncommon. But I think I love that you asked this question, because our chapter one is micro skills for self-care. And part of taking care of yourself is actually staying healthy mentally, emotionally, physically. And I think the more you are healthy and have started with yourself, the more you'll actually notice flags when something doesn't feel quite right.
Thank you. So the last two questions I have, I'm going to just kind of toss out, and appreciate the interactions from each of you individually. But collectively, what advice do you have for students who want to advance in their professional goals, but lack this support structure that we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes?
definitely from my personal experience, I would say don't wait for someone to come and course correct. If you are feeling stuck and lost, reach out for help, guidance. And that can be done by, obviously, the people closest to you would be your family and friends, but there's bias there in that they could be giving you a lot of positivity and reassurance. And maybe what you actually need is strategic guidance and more constructive criticism. So you definitely want to get a mix of people who you can turn to, advisors, mentors, deans, those sorts of things. Social media has been really helpful for me when it comes to finding support elsewhere that I didn't have within my institution. And some of that support is just in the form of peer-to-peer mentorship. So meeting other people who are of my same age, same position, and just exchanging ideas, collaborating, working together, debriefing, venting, all of those things. I feel like social media removes a lot of geographic restrictions that I wouldn't have had, that I had prior to joining, because I was thinking that everyone who's going to help me would be in my immediate department. But those people are busy. Perhaps their skills don't align with my knowledge gaps. And so I really had to look elsewhere. And it was really moving from that passive to active state that really put me, I feel like, on the next level of growing my career.
We talk about in the book that nobody is coming to save you. Nobody's losing sleep about your lecture. And I think it is really easy when you feel stuck, when you're going through a hard time, when you've had some bad situations at work, to think you're the only one, to think you're alone. And personally, I have found a lot of solace and help by reading and with books, because books help normalize certain situations and you realize you're not alone. And I really think we wrote this book to let people know they're not alone. Like, we've been there. And here are some things that, gosh, it took us a long time to learn, but here, learn it sooner. So you asked, how can people build this or learn this? Start with our book. And we think it's a good tool. We think it'll help people. We hope it helps people.
Well, I certainly have enjoyed the conversation and want to thank both Dr. Lewis and Dr. Landry. Their book, Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact, will be released on April 16th and is available for pre-order wherever you get your books. Until then, doctors, where can our listeners learn more about you and your work?
We're on all the socials. So LinkedIn, you can just type in our names and you'll find us. Instagram, as well as Twitter/X. We also have personal websites. I'm AdairLandryMD.com, and I think Risa is RisaELewisMD.com. Google is going to be your friend here. Just type our names in and you'll see what we're writing, speaking about, and also where you can find us on social media.
What a great conversation. You certainly have given listeners a lot to think about and digest. It has been my absolute pleasure, Dr. Landry, Dr. Lewis, to have you on this edition of Sage Advice. And I hope that you will feel free to come back and join us again. Thank you for a great dialogue.
Thank you. We'd love to.
Thank you.
Sage Advice is brought to you by Western Governors University. To learn more about WGU and how it's pioneering a new path in higher education, visit wgu.edu. If you enjoyed our discussion today, don't forget to subscribe to Sage Advice wherever you get your podcasts. Join us next time for more insightful conversations. Until then, keep learning, keep growing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what education can achieve. From the team here at WGU, thank you for listening to Sage Advice.